I'm calling the summer editions of the Everything is a Primary Source podcast Part 2 Palooza. We'll be picking up where we left off with the second halves to the second half of Season 2 episodes of the show. Next up, my conversation with Chance Kelly regarding some of the parkways leading to and around New York City. My guest hosts his own podcast called Island, which is all about the history of Manhattan and has just started Season 2. Chance and I connected because of a shared passion for history, particularly the parts of the past that are hidden in plain sight. Parkways, or really any roadway, fit not only this description, but also the idea of irregular primary sources, which is this show's specialty. The first part of this episode, which was published in February of this year, delves into the Robert Moses-led development of the Bronx River and Hutchinson River parkways, which were completed, at least the Westchester County sections, in the 1920s. Part 2 picks up as we head into the Depression era and beyond, looking at what the building, naming, and timing of these roadways can tell us about the people, economics, and even politics of each era. Before we dive back into this very interesting topic, I want to tell you where you can find Everything as a Primary Source online. Everythinghistory.com is your landing place to connect to the show's Substack, Instagram, as well as the Facebook group, not to mention where you can learn about the Everything's a Primary Source mindset, methods, and my consulting and coaching offerings. That's www.everything-history.com. And now, on to part two.
So I was just doing a podcast a few weeks ago with a gentleman called the Retroologist. And we were talking about Howard Johnson's and Holiday Inn, you know, those roadside motels. And Howard Johnson's, even before it became a motel, was the, you know, the Howard Johnson's restaurant that was set up shop on so many different turnpikes up and down the country. And of course, our conversation went towards, you know, second half of the 20th century and off the interstates. The parkways that we're talking about, they wouldn't have room for a rest area, would they? That's not that kind of road. It was never meant to be, right?
No, in fact, on the Bronx River, right in my neighborhood, I'm in New Rochelle, New York. That's where I live now. But and on that, you go across, it's the Scarsdale exit. There are the old stone rest areas, the gas station bathroom rest areas. They haven't used them in decades.
Right.
They're there. They're beautiful old stone buildings that Robert Moses probably put in, but they use them for like, they're open like twice a week to hand out pamphlets of the pathway, you know.
That's funny. So yeah. Because they were probably put in when cars moved a lot slower than they do now, and you know, could, you know, pull in and use the restroom or something like that. But
exactly. I mean, you get on that Bronx River, you kind of need to be in a Model T to feel comfortable. Right. That thing is tight.
Right. So, I mean, there goes the question of, you know, why did they make it? Was it specific to the commuter you know, demographic? Was it specific to people who were, you know, like you, live outside the city, but work in the city? Is that, you know, because it was never meant to be moving large scale freight anywhere.
No, what you see with the parkways, these specific parkways, is as we said, the development, the increasing presence of automobile travel, cultivated the trajectory for people up and out of the city. And this is another reason why I think Eric Jaffe's book is so interesting, because it, that route, you know, the King's Best Highway is essentially the story of Route One that runs from, as you know, New York to Boston, but it's as much about the railroads as anything. Right. And he gets into all that entire era and Cornelius Vanderbilt and everybody else along the way. And New Rochelle, for instance, is a good example, because it was really the first suburb. It was really the first suburb of New York City. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to go back several hundred years, people will tell you Greenwich Village was the first suburb of New York City. But out of Manhattan,
right,
New Rochelle was really the first area that developed as a real formidable town. And it was largely because of that route. It wasn't just the train line going there, but it was literally that Route 1 ran right through it.
So, yeah, that whole purpose of getting more people to the city, I guess we could keep extending it further and further out, though, because, and when we talked about this a few weeks ago, I think we have to bring in the Erie Canal into this, into a certain extent, because New York, you know, we have this perspective of New York being the epicenter of all commerce and finance, and that's why people are living there and driving into the city. And we're talking specifically from the northern suburbs, but then, you know, you think about the 20s and the, you know, going out to Long Island and the people, you know, driving in from all directions, really. But New York wouldn't be that financial capital, would not be what it was had it not been for the canal so many miles north and cutting across the entire state, because that's that connection to the Great Lakes and then to Chicago and to Milwaukee and all those places out west where everything's moving back and forth and then down the Hudson River to New York and then back again, making New York City, in Manhattan in particular, that transfer station. That's where everything's being changed. That's where all the money's being changed, where it's being borrowed. That's where the cargo is coming and going, and people's jobs are built on it. I mean, the story of every city is trade, and that's how they grow. It can't be understated that the Erie Canal has all that. So it's almost like no Erie Canal, no need for all of these roads that are getting the employees, all the working people of New York, you know, the professionals mainly, you know, who are living outside the city, to and from their jobs, you know, 100 years later. I think it's actually kind of fitting that the Bronx River Parkway was completed almost 100 years when the Erie Canal began construction a century before.
There's no doubt that the Erie Canal is a major impact on the trajectory and the growth of New York City. It's a pivotal landmark in its history, and it really made New York, New York is what it did. It went from being a port city that had some advantages to it to becoming an international hub of industry, as you said. And what it really did was it reduced the cost of moving goods from the Midwest all the way to New York, not just to New York, but, you know, it dropped the cost of moving from Rochester to Buffalo by like a third, you know, and suddenly New York State was a major player in international industry and shipping.
And the, you know, and DeWitt Clinton's contributions to all of them. I mean, he basically was the man who made the Erie Canal happen in the first place, make an entirely New York State project. And the wedding of the waters that, you know, he did after it opened with bringing water from the Atlantic Ocean to, you know, to the Lake Erie and Buffalo and then vice versa, you know, to put the waterways together. Fittingly, the Jets are playing in Buffalo right now, having their own marriage of the, you know, meeting of the two waterways. And maybe even unbeknownst to them, that's why they're even, you know, two major cities that, you know, are connected by this thing. There doesn't seem to be, I mean, at least as far as I know, I mean, there's ceremony behind that, and that's because it was such a big deal. They understood as they were making this canal, its effects even before they got to see them play out. They knew it was going to be that way, and it's only fitting that the train that came a few, you know, not even a decade later, that mirrors the Erie Canal is called the DeWitt Clinton. You know, that was going to be the connection between the East and the West in New York, and then, you know, down south into the city. Was it that big of a deal when these parkways opened? Did they have big ceremonies, ribbon cuttings, or anything like that? Or was it just kind of like, yep, there's another road. There's another road that, you know, we just need these.
It was a major deal that the, as far as the Robert Moses part of the story, which is a huge part of the transportation story in the greater metropolitan area, it was largely, it's amazing. This is why good biographies blow me away. And if you read Robert Caro's The Power Broker, it tells you all this stuff. It's amazing. It came from his passion for swimming, if you can believe that. So he was a city guy, right? And he was in the boroughs. And he was a guy from some level of society. Like, his parents had some money, so he could go, like, to a friend's mansion out in Long Island and swim. Mm-hmm. But most people couldn't. We take it for granted. I don't know if you grew up going to Jones Beach, but I totally did. And it's a beautiful beach. And again, we take this stuff for granted. I do. Anyway, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I go out to Jones Beach. I'm just like, oh, it's a big, huge, beautiful beach out on you know, the southern shore of Long Island. It didn't exist. It literally didn't exist. So Moses was a real thinker.
Yeah.
He knew that if he built this incredible beach that was, it was extravagant, his details for this thing, the bathhouses and the way they built it and the sand they used, that people would need a way to get there. Back in the early 20s, there was nowhere, and 30s, there was nowhere to go ocean swimming except mm-hmm. Coney Island. And at that time, Coney Island was just, you know, it was overcrowded and it was not that nice. And it was an amusement park and it was a whole different approach. And it was a more of a turn of the century, turn of the 19th century kind of place.
Well, and that brings in their last figure in this, and that'd be Roosevelt, because even before the New Deal and before, you know, the Civilian Conservation Corps actually came to be, and you mentioned with Taconic Parkway and being his, you know, brainchild,
right?
That seemed to be the way of thinking for progressive thinkers of the time, because he wholeheartedly supported those ideas of giving young men in particular jobs of beautifying and either creating or making better those kinds of like beaches and, you know, hiking paths and ski resorts are all kind of resulting. And so when the Depression hit and his part of his New Deal, that was his favorite of the alphabet soup of programs, was the CCC, because he just thought it was just great, because here's, you know, the Army's going to run this thing. It's going to be young men going all over the country, everywhere from mountainsides to the beachfronts, you know, either creating it, making it better, updating it. In the city that I teach in here in New Hampshire, they have, similar to what you're describing, a much smaller scale, of course, it was a swimming hole that had, you know, people in one of the rivers next to one of the old mills, fittingly, the kids would go swimming in there. And then in one summer in, I think, 1937, the CCC came in and they built up these beautiful stone walkways and a diving board platform. And they had a bathhouse, you know, a changing, you know, and the big beachfront and everything. So it looked like a little slice of the ocean, you know, down the road right there in town, because, like you said, people couldn't get there. So I think it's only appropriate, you know, and on the one hand, you're like, oh, why did, you know, East River Drive get the, you know, name FDR right after he dies? Well, he's part of that whole big puzzle too, isn't he? You know, Roosevelt isn't just a bystander. He's not just somebody who's admiring the work of people like Robert Moses. He's probably one of them.
There's no doubt. And, you know, while the two Roosevelt families were at odds politically, the Teddy Roosevelt family versus the Franklin Roosevelt family.
Yeah.
He shared, FDR shared Teddy's love for the wilderness. And he sort of took the baton from Teddy in some respects. And he was from Hyde Park, New York. You can visit you may have been there, the Hyde Park mansion of the Roosevelts, upstate New York. But he had a real fondness for that landscape and those beautiful mountains and hills and streams. And he was instrumental. It's funny. He and Robert Moses hated each other. He came along just a little bit after Moses was already in with Al Smith. So Roosevelt became governor. He took the governorship from after Al Smith. But they did work together to get the parks going. And the Taconic is a perfect example, because he was in charge of that when Robert Moses was building the parkways out on Long Island. And then they eventually met in the middle.
Yeah. I mean, these were, they were builders. They were developing, you know, for the 20th century. And I think his presidency matches that too. Roosevelt, you know, Franklin Roosevelt's did. And like you said, both of them, you know, his, was it like seventh cousins or something like that? They were maybe not quite that remote, but they were
distant cousins. I think fifth cousins.
And they knew each other and they were, you know, familiar, you know, obviously Teddy being elder, but that whole era, that early 20th century, I mean, the country and New York is no exception to this, took off like a shot right after the turn of the century. I mean, just overnight, largely because of Teddy, had become an empire, had this whole new, you know, industrial immigrant labor force coming in. It was just like a whole new world. And so they were builders. They had to build, in this case, lower New York State and the Tri-City area into a functioning, you know, all parts of the factors of production had to be functioning at best capacity. And, you know, people are going to have time to themselves in this modern economy. They're going to be able to have weekend trips. They're going to have 8 hours each day to do whatever they want, you know, because of the way that the economics had changed so much, that they were not just, you know, working in a factory for 14 hours and going back, you know, going to sleep in a tenement house somewhere. They were living outside the city. They wanted to enjoy parks, hence park, you know, all these parkways. They usually, you know, connect to a park at some point. This is all products of that, you know, early 20th century building mentality, this progress mentality. So it's very, it is appropriate then to name a very important road in Manhattan itself after Roosevelt.
There's no doubt. Plus the other thing symbolically, what he represents is his lineage goes back to both the Dutch colonization and the Mayflower. So yeah. Isaac Allerton is a descendant. He's a Mayflower descendant. He's a relative of Roosevelt's. So is Claes Martensen Rosenvelt, who came from Amsterdam in the 1640s. So they've got deep, long lineage here.
And it's, and again, one that I think maybe because of the time period that Roosevelt was president, he almost became himself part of popular culture that people in his own time didn't really recognize the reach and the depth that he had. I mean, I think he had some family line even in the southeast and part of the country too. It was, you know, the some kind of Confederate ancestry.
Well, he's also a Huguenot. He's got Huguenot ties, which were very close to the Walloons who founded New York.
Okay.
New Netherland, rather.
Right. And because I another big project of his actually this October, but he didn't really much have something to do with the project, but I remember seeing video of him dedicating it. We went out to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania this fall, and that's where they have the Eternal Peace Light Memorial, which is my favorite of all the monuments at Gettysburg. And it was, you know, it's dedicated to, you know, forever peace between North and South. And I remember, you know, it wasn't just because he was president of the United States that he dedicated it there. It was because he had his own family had Southerners and Northerners in it. And so it was like a personal, you know, thing for him to, you know, symbolize that harmony between the sections of the country. So, yeah, I think to give him a strip of a highway is actually kind of a disservice to FDR, you know, just to say, yeah, these four lanes right here, you know.
Well, maybe they should have given him the West Side Highway, because that's the one I always go. That's my go to. I avoid the FDR whenever possible.
Yeah,
it's
always congested. I was going to say the West Side isn't. Is that named anything specific?
No, but you have to pay for that one, too. So, you got to pay the Henry Hudson Bridge to go in there. But it's just, for whatever reason, it doesn't get nearly as congested.
Do you think that, because I know that, you know, Roosevelt and Al Smith had, they were political allies for a while, but then they parted ways as far as being, you know, and governor. He was the governor after Al Smith was, and they both ran for president in 32. Roosevelt gets the nomination.
It was a Democratic primary, and FDR ended up getting it. He was an unlikely candidate, believe it or not. It's amazing, because one of our most formative presidents was extremely unlikely to be a presidential candidate at that point.
Yeah, because he didn't have that. I mean, despite what we know is his deep connections to the country, he didn't seem to connect, you know, kind of had that Ivy League, you know, kind of snobbish, you know, way to him, Roosevelt's, you know, that a lot of people they were worried that he wouldn't connect with people around the country.
That's exactly right. He, Moses was more of an old boy kind of network guy. And so was, wow, Smith, they were Tammany Hall guys.
Yeah.
Moses didn't start out as a Tammany Hall guy, but Al Smith was, it was in his fingernails being a Tammany Hall guy. Eventually, Roosevelt, they aligned, but Roosevelt initially was not looked at very highly by those guys. They didn't think that he was one of the old boys. Or
I was going to say, because a highway or any kind of structure in New York City is straight up Tammany Hall, kind of like what they did. It was like getting the contracts and the builders and, buying the land and all that kind of stuff. So in a way, I wonder, and they were, Tammany Hall was, that machine that was really, based on the immigrant population, Lower East Side, like they just really ate that up and exploited it. I wonder if that's why they went, instead of calling it the Al Smith, drive and naming it FDR, was like, because by the time you get to World War II, that's like the end of the line for the big old political machines. Yeah,
it's true. Al Smith was sort of erased from history. It's interesting because he was an incredible guy, totally opposite FDR. He grew up on the Lower East Side penniless and became an unlikely candidate for governor, became governor. And as you said, he was mayor first. And then, he ran for president. He damn near could have won the second time he ran in. But they at the 11th hour, they gave the nod to the powers that be, gave the nod to FDR.
Yeah.
They just felt that he was going to provide more promise.
And he, with the Al Smith being wet and Roman Catholic, that was something that Roosevelt wasn't. The Democrats are really divided in the 20s. They didn't have, that footing that they eventually did under Roosevelt for the next couple decades. I wonder if, by 45, after he had navigated the country through the Depression and into World War II and the war was coming to an end, that, because of the actual geographic location of that road, that it should have, goes right past Al Smith's neighborhood. It's like you'd think they would call it the Al Smith Highway, or something like that. And it's, who was the mayor of New York in the 40s? Was that LaGuardia or?
LaGuardia, yeah. LaGuardia replaced, I think, Jimmy Walker at that point.
You wonder if that was some kind of.
Well, LaGuardia got his stuff. He certainly got his name on some things, right?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
But it's funny. You're right. Al Smith didn't get much. He didn't get much stuff in his name.
Maybe because his name is so simple. Maybe a lot more things are named after him. We just don't know it because just Smith,
He also built the Empire State Building in the middle of the Depression. Al Smith did.
Yeah. And yet that, doesn't
It's kind of lost to history, isn't it?
Yeah. And it is. But it's almost like, that's what I love about dissecting things rather than just taking them as face value, is because the story behind the story is always, if you're driving on the FDR, maybe you're listening to this right now and, trying to navigate through that road. Everything has a purpose to it. Everything was named for a reason, it's not just a, throwaway thing. And I think there has to be some symbology behind that one, as far as the timing of it and the location of it, that, because other things have been named FDR, that really don't have the same kind of legitimacy. But having a roads like bridges and everything else, associated with them, there's something meaningful behind them because they connect people, they get you where you're going. And this one, I think, was almost like a shoved in the face. Because speaking of Route 1, and I know I just kind of bounced all over the place, but you were talking before about the Post Road. The Post Road extension goes from Boston to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And that is also, it's Route 1 now. And that was, a product of the 20s of the U.S. routes. But is for a long time and continues to be named Lafayette Road, because that's where the Marquis de Lafayette, when he was touring the country in his 1820 tour of the United States, his big return, pretty much everywhere he went, they were naming things after him. Mm-hmm. And that's where that road gets its name, is Lafayette Road. And, you know, so similar kind of background to it. And again, I'm sure people that are going up and down that road every single day, hundreds of them, thousands of them, they call it Lafayette Road. It's on their address if they're on that road, but they don't know, you know, that has to do with, you know, that it was maybe not politically charged, but it was historically charged, that the reasoning behind it was because they wanted to recognize somebody. So same thing with all three of these parkways.
Well, he's a good guy to recognize, because without him and without his country, we wouldn't have won this war. We wouldn't have won the first war.
Right.
It absolutely wouldn't have happened.
Everything else would have, you know, fallen. It was like,
yeah. And then you can figure out, you can guesstimate what would have happened, you know, from
it's there. Just the other day, President Macron from France was visiting the United States, you know, his first state visit for the Biden administration at the White House to host. And they just kind of said it, and I read a headline in a newspaper, just kind of set it off the cuff. They're like, yeah, America's oldest ally. I'm like, yeah, that's actually exactly what the French are, you know. And even more hats off to Lafayette is that he was the vanguard. He wasn't even part of the official coalition of troops. He was just so inspired by Washington and what the you know, the armies of liberty were fighting for, that he wanted part of it, and that he put his own money up and his own risk, his life, you know, to go take part in that. And yeah, so
that's what I think it's important for people to remember, what it took to build this country.
Yeah,
all the way back. And I mean, even before the Revolution, but guys like Lafayette and Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, where would we be without those guys? We'd be nowhere. We wouldn't have a nation. I mean, that's a fact.
Yeah. And they were taking all the stuff that had come before them, you know, the things we were mentioning before about the Puritans arriving in Massachusetts and the Dutch setting up in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
You know, that they would have definitely not had much to work with. You know, they wouldn't have envisioned that way. You mentioned Hamilton's name. Like, he was such a unique figure, and he's being celebrated in pop culture as we speak here in the 2010s and 20s. But the reason why is because he saw everything from an outsider's perspective. And Franklin to a certain extent too, because he was from Boston and moved to Philadelphia and then lived in England for a while. He could see things that way too. And he's another one. Both those guys are two guys that things are named for all the time, and you don't recognize it until you do a little bit of, you know, scraping away of the veneer. You're like, oh yeah, that's why it's named Franklin, you know, because he, you know, is he pretty much brought the Enlightenment to America himself personally. Like, he brought that and then distributed it in his writing and his printing. And he was there he helped write the Declaration of Independence. And then 20 years later, he's there for, or not even 20 years, 10 years later, he's there for the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. You know, he's there sculpting the country. So I think the least we can do is name, you know, a town here and there, Franklin, you know.
He's also one of the lost heroes of this, of our story. Cause I think because he wasn't president, he does get lost a little bit.
Yeah.
But he's the grandfather of our sovereign nation. I mean, that's a fact.
Yeah.
You know, what he did is incredible in the overall scope of this thing. And actually, talk about Route One. That was his brainchild. I mean, the post office was his.
Yeah. There's still some cultivated. Those mile markers you can find around here in New England that, if not him directly, chiseled them out. You know, it's because of him.
He put those in. That was like, his. You
know, that, the writers
that
need
was
to
his
know
commission.
Where
put
they're
this
going.
Here. There's one in Inwood still on Manhattan. Now, I looked at it the other day. For whatever reason, the lettering is all gone. But
really?
The marker is, it's the 12 mile marker. If you measure it from basically from Wall Street, well, no, from where the fort was, it's 12 miles.
Wow.
And it's still there. It's still embedded in a stone wall right on the side of Broadway.
That's great. Amazing. That's so great. And it's like, again, I mean, that's so, we're fortunate here in the East Coast to have so much of that history, even if it's shrouded by, you know, in the case of like, buildings in New York City are crowding it, or, you know, sometimes I go past, like, I can think of some of the mile markers around here that is like a Taco Bell, you know, one side of it. You blink and you miss it kind of thing, but it's there because of that vision that they had back then. And, you know, I think a lot of this also factors into a bit of a historiography type discussion where, you know, the early Americans, whether they be the founders of the country or people like Anne Hutchinson or Bronk, you know, the people that came before, they kind of cycle through popular culture as far as any, you know, like back in the early 2000s, it was John Adams. He was the founder. He was the early American figure that people were fascinated with. And it really matched the time period of that late 90s, early 2000s attitude. And then now more recently, it's been Hamilton and, you know, Washington peppers in there. Jefferson shows up. Franklin, big name in the late 19th century with all that scientific, you know, that industrial revolution that was happening. People celebrated Franklin like crazy because he's like the father of, you know, American scientific, you know, gathering and stuff like that. So like, yeah, we're going to put him up on the pedestal when our society, you know, wants that as our forefront. So I'm wondering when a name like Hutchinson or even Roosevelt, you know, enough time has gone by now that Roosevelt might be moving up towards another upswing of being, you know, a society holds him up on a pedestal again. I don't know.
Ken Burns did a remarkable, one of my favorite documentaries ever. Did you see the Roosevelt
documentary? I did, yeah. Oh, I was captivated. It was so good.
I've watched it straight through three times.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And it's, so maybe our podcast today did a little bit of rambling, but that's appropriate because we're talking about roads, and that's what you do with a road, is you ramble down them. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And what do you have on the horizon for your podcast?
Well, we're coming out with season two with the new year, sometime between spring and Labor Day. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to be Labor Day, but I'm going to be working on that shortly. And that'll take us from 1626, Pierre Minuit, who people know as Peter Minuit, but Pierre Minuit, the one who bought the island, mm-hmm. through 1637 to March 1638, right before this guy named Keefe shows up.
Okay.
So that's season two. So you're going to get Pierre Minuit and you're going to get Van Twiller, who is, if people know Governor's Island, he's the governor that gave it that name because he bought up a bunch of islands back when he was here. he was not the best dude.
Where are we with, what is it, Peter?
Stuyvesant,
yeah.
He was the last director, the last governor.
Okay.
I like to call them governors because it goes right back to the fact that that island was named for the third to last governor. Of the colony, which is
he has a strip mall named after him in Albany. I know that.
Well, he's got a great apartment complex here.
All right.
In New York, that was actually done by, I think, Robert Moses was very involved in putting that in.
So
was right where it's called Stuytown because that's where his Bowery was.
And isn't Bedford Stuy, the Stuy in Bedford Stuy is Stuyvesant, right? It's named.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the history of that name, but that's the Stuyvesant. Now it could be a later Stuyvesant because the family was here for a long time.
They stuck around.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say is about this is this past summer, my family, we went to Amsterdam, not New Amsterdam, but Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And while we were there, I was talking, this young woman we went to a store and she was wearing a Friends t-shirt. And we were chatting about it, and I told her, and I don't know how she'd know this, but I said, they didn't film the show in New York. They filmed it. I know it takes place in New York, but, you know, they filmed it in L.A. And she's like, oh, really? Okay. I didn't know that. And I'm like,
which show?
Friends. You know,
Friends.
It wasn't until afterwards, I'm like, that was such a good possibility to talk because, you know, New Amsterdam is where Friends is set. And I was in Old Amsterdam and I totally missed that connection between the two because, you know, it's funny because of the Duke of York's involvement in New York. And that's why the name still sticks. I think
he got it for a birthday present.
The Dutch history doesn't really shine so brightly to people, even in Netherlands. You know, you'd think that they would be, you know, that
they stole it. The English stole it.
Yeah. It was
and it was Winthrop Jr. that stole it.
Maybe quite the touchy subject. I'm glad I didn't go any further with it. Like, hey, tell me what you think about this. Yeah. Well, Chance, thank you so much for taking the time. And I look forward to working with you again, perhaps in the future on the EPS podcast.
Same, Eric. Very, 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 very much so. I appreciate you having me, and I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
And for all of you, thank you for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including all those parkways that connect around New York City, are primary sources. We'll talk to you next time.
I'm always looking for topic ideas for the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, so if you have one in mind, don't hesitate to contact me. And if you're up for a good chat, I'd love to have you on the show to talk about it. Contact and follow me on social media, including Facebook and YouTube, and especially Instagram, where I hang out the most. Tune in next time for more history through pop culture.